Hello, and thanks for joining us at Seen and Unseen Aloud. My name is Natalie Garrett. This is where you get to listen to a curated collection of the editor's top picks from our recent articles. We're here for you when you need to be eyes-free or hands-free, but still want to hear Christian perspectives on just about everything. Temperance, Neurotic Vice or Self-Control for Future Benefit by Barnabas Asprey. The 21st century is witnessing a crisis of temperance, self-discipline, and self-control. Lent is one way to combat this. According to the International Leader Character Framework, there are 11 character strengths important for human well-being and good leadership. These include virtues like justice, accountability, courage, and good judgment. Researchers have used this framework to perform thousands of studies on teams and groups of people around the world. These studies show that, almost without exception, temperance is the weakest virtue in every team, everywhere. Not quite every person. Each team has one or two members with strong temperance, but temperance is still weakest on average for a group. The modern world is not only intemperate, it actively encourages the opposite, immediate gratification of desires. Every day we are bombarded with online ads, posters and TV commercials that tell us to indulge yourself, treat yourself, look after yourself, along with images of sensually pleasing people and objects. It is a rare advert that appeals to your calm rationality and long-term thinking. The advertising industry knows that it can make much more money from people who lack self-control. If it targets your basic animal impulses, then you are more likely to buy things you don't need and wouldn't have thought of without ads' enticing promise. Worse still, there are elements of Western thought that praise intemperance as a virtue and pathologize restraint as a psychological disorder. Elements of Freudian psychoanalysis, popularized in the media, suggest that you do damage to your mental health if you suppress your desires or try to hide them. It is far healthier to give free rein to sexual desire, first of all, but to all desires in the end. Temperance is no longer a virtue to be admired, but a neurotic vice that fills your subconscious with envy, bitterness, and psychological problems. What is temperance anyway, and why is it a problem if we lack it? Temperance is self-control. It is acquired by self-discipline. Its purpose is to organize and order your many desires, giving priority to the ones that matter most to you. Let's say you want to lose weight and you also want to eat that donut that you can see in the shop window. Or you want to save money to buy a house, but you also want that new and larger TV screen. Those are competing desires. Temperance is the power to choose what you won't regret choosing later on. It doesn't tell you what you ought to choose. It simply gives you control over your desires, so you rule over them instead of them ruling you. What does lack of temperance look like? Well, whenever you keep doing something you wish you didn't keep doing, you are being intemperate. I don't mean one-time actions that you later regret. I mean things you know you'll regret even before you do them, yet still you do them. Things like smoking, for most people, eating too much, browsing Instagram or TikTok instead of working, failing to show up for gym classes. It can also mean any kind of procrastination, avoiding doing a task you know you have to do, but you don't want to do now. In sum, it reveals a disorganization in your priorities and goals, so a lesser priority subverts a higher priority because it's more immediately available and enjoyable. The problem with lacking temperance is that it undermines your own goals for your life and makes your future self a helpless victim of your present self. It leads to a downward spiral, as at the heart of intemperance is some desire, some pleasure, some indulgence that has gained so much power over our life that we are no longer in control over it. It is in the driving seat, not us. Intemperance is also a cause of self-hatred and low self-esteem. One of the best ways to feel better about yourself is to set long-term goals and stick to them. Makes you feel like you're heading somewhere good. By contrast, the heart of temperance is to subordinate everything we think, feel, and enjoy to our will, our clear-headed decisions about the kind of person we want to be in the long term. We need temperance if we're going to be happy with where our lives are going. Temperance is even needed for worldly success. Warren Buffett once said, "Investing is not a game where the guy with 160 IQ beats the guy with 130 IQ. Once you have ordinary intelligence, what you need is the temperament to control the urges that get other people into trouble." Why is temperance so lacking in our time? I can think of at least two reasons. First, we are one of the wealthiest societies ever to exist. Wealth may have benefits, but it also enables us to get what we want when we want it. Wealthy people are less used to having their desires unsatisfied than poor people. Unfulfilled longing is a less common occurrence for the rich, so there is little natural opportunity to exercise the muscle of self-denial. Secondly, we are one of the least religious societies ever to exist. In contrast to secularism, religion has always had practical tools to cultivate temperance. All major world religions have ritual practices of fasting and feasting designed to exercise and strengthen self-discipline. Every year, Muslims endure the grueling discipline of Ramadan. Orthodox Christians restrict themselves to a vegan diet during the 40 days of Lent, and many other Christians give up some indulgence. Both rich and poor share alike in this voluntary self-denial. Now that these practices are eroding away, they are being replaced not by other self-discipline practices, but by the worship of "I want it here and now." This is shown most poignantly in the 2000 movie Chocolat, which explicitly puts up sensual indulgence in competition to traditional religion and abstinence. And indulgence wins. But the decline of religion has done more than this. It has also undermined the sense of transcendent purpose in many people's lives, which was what motivated them to look beyond their physical desires. Without hope and without a larger sense of meaning to life, people have less reason to sacrifice short-term pleasures for the sake of longer-term goals. I don't mean that short-term pleasures are always bad or that sensual desire is evil in itself. The whole point of temperance is that it involves the right amount and not too much of something good. That is what makes it so tricky. If eating a donut was like stealing or violence, we would have a stronger voice telling us not to do it. But because it's not bad in itself, we find it harder to resist. We need temperance to say no to something good when we've already had enough of it, so we don't take too much. Nor are sensual desires the only way that we can be intemperate. An outburst of rage on social media is a sign of intemperance. A father who spends too long in the office and not enough time with his children is being intemperate. He is sacrificing the long-term goal of healthy family relationships for the short-term goal of career success. We lack the self-control to express our anger in the right place at the right time. Temperance is needed for so many of the other virtues to function. If you're not temperate, then you will be late for meetings, fail to deliver work on time, or make too many commitments that you can't keep. You'll be a liability to your friends and to your colleagues. Temperance doesn't tell you what you should aim for in life. But no matter what you aim for, you won't get it without temperance. So what have you been giving up for Lent? Raw Politics at Easter. Where's the Hope? By Owen Gallagher. They say Putin is not in touch with reality. But when it comes to raw fundamental political reality, maybe he is. It could well be true that all our chat about goodness and beauty and love and faith is mere decoration, like a layer of fake grass that we use to cover over the harsher concrete facts of our existence. Things like the basic violence of the natural order and the raw power politics inherent in our competing systems. We even have a habit of bestowing the prefix real on such politics. So is this real stuff the concrete base layer of our existence? Is it the deepest truth? Is it the uncompromising reality that is always there, even as we prefer to cover it over with the fake grass of our stories of the beautiful and sweet songs of love? Most of the evidence points that way. The stockpiles of nukes, the cutthroat colleagues, the succession of bullies intent on becoming the next big dog in the raw struggle for power. I remember witnessing a violent assault at the tender age of 8, and the impact of encountering this ugliness on my young heart was a new shadow of fear. Suddenly the world was a colder and darker place. Then I grew up and became a priest, which raises the question of whether I am spending my life just whistling in the dark to feel better. Am I just tending to the fake grass? The celebration of Easter does not deny the darkness, does not cover over the concrete. It claims instead that the ugly concrete base has in fact been cracked open to reveal a deeper subsoil, that there is something even more real, more true, more fundamental than the brutal struggle for power we currently all suffer within. And this is the high stakes of Easter. And here lies the deep and central significance of an obscure death on a Roman cross. It is the moment in which God, who is primordial love, faces up to the violent worst of murderous evil. Not with angel armies to crush our sorry, war-torn mess under a new almighty domination, which would only serve to confirm the lasting truth of the dark concrete layer, but by contradicting it, undermining it, through a humble death, followed by resurrection. I write it out, and to be honest, it's kind of surprising to me just how many people keep believing this unlikely story to be literally and deeply and seriously true. Could be because most of us are not prepared to be as clear-sighted as Putin and the others, that for some reason we remain relatively unable to cope with being so brutally in touch with the cold, dark facts of the ugly concrete. Or could it be that our intuitions of beauty and experiences of love are, gloriously, not the stuff of fake grass and psychological coping mechanism, but actually have their roots deep down into the subsoil of an infinite beauty and an ultimate love? If so, could be that the strongest counter-evidence available to us, countering all the nukes and the bullies and the violent domination, is noticing what lifts our hearts and moves us to tears. Beauty can do that. Violence cannot. And so I keep whistling. Easter tells us that we are missed by someone. By Nathan Betts. Is there a person in your life that you just love spending time with? Maybe this is a family member, a friend, colleague, neighbour, or maybe your spouse. As time has gone on in your life, you now realise how special that person is to you. You think of the ease, the peace, the low heartbeat, lightheartedness, and depth of feeling that you've experienced all in simply being with that person and spending time with them. As you think of that person, can you remember a time when there was a longer than usual gap between your visits, maybe weeks, months, years? What was it like when you met up and talked to this special friend of yours after the hiatus? What did it feel like? I have someone like this. His name is Andrew. He's my cousin. But I've generally thought of him as the brother I never had. We grew up together, separated by only 1 year in age. My childhood is filled with memories of playing with him in different sports, games, wrestling, arguing, disagreeing, pranking each other, late-night fast food runs, which I'd no longer recommend, and eventually working long shifts on low sleep together. We were in each other's wedding parties. We have experienced a lot of life together. As time has gone on, and I now live on the other side of the continent, we have not been able to see each other as often as we would like. But recently, he had a special work trip close to the Pacific Northwest, so he made time for a short stay with us near Seattle. On one day, I took him out for street tacos near the ocean, and we were able to get some unhurried time to catch up. Throughout his visit, I just kept thinking how much I'd miss spending time with Andrew. He and I both expressed as much. If you have just one of those friendships in life, you have hit the ball out of the park. If you have two or three of those friendships, you've had a grand slam. These friendships are unique. As a theologian by education, I often think of these relational traits when it comes to God. Fundamental to Christian belief is that we can, despite how infinitely different he is to us, relate to God. There is a great deal of mystery to this idea, to be sure, but I've wondered long and hard what this looks like. In the long history of Christian thought, scholars, pastors, and theologians have pointed to Jesus Christ to help make sense of this massive, otherworldly concept. The Hebrew scriptures reveal what God is like in creation, miracles, acts of grace, displays of power, and many other aspects. But when we are searching to understand how God relates to us as human beings, it is Jesus Christ who gives us the primary lens through which we can understand that quality of relationship. The interactions he has with friends, with leaders, children, teachers are especially revealing. The way he heals people, enjoys meals with others, gives time to the outsiders and speaks to the uptight religious types, it's all very instructive in how God relates to us as human beings. Over the last few years, I have become increasingly interested in the questions that Jesus asks people. Jesus' questions reveal to us what he is like. Why do you call me good? Who do you say that I am? Whose image is on this coin? Will you also leave me? What do you want me to do for you? These and many more have caused me to explore further the questions that God asks people throughout the scriptures, because maybe his questions, sometimes more than his statements, reveal what makes him different. For me, one of the most striking and poignant questions throughout the Bible is when God asks Adam, "Where are you?" Since childhood, I've wondered what God was doing in asking that question. God was not asking a geographical question. It's not as though his internal GPS was confused in the Garden of Eden. But if not a geography question, was God then playing an intellectual game with Adam and Eve? Perhaps, but that is increasingly doubtful given the enormous stakes in that narrative. Brokenness had just entered the world, as well as the message we read throughout the rest of the Bible. God takes people seriously. Recently, I wrote to my friend and leading Old Testament scholar Bruce Waltaker to see what he thought about God's question to Adam. Perhaps you'll find an excerpt of his answer as enlightening as I have. The omniscient God is not asking because he does not know. He is asking a real question. This is not a charade. To show his involvement with Adam, both an historical and archetype of humanity, to provoke him to engage with him in dialogue. In short, God misses his fellowship. God is asking Adam where he is because he misses him. Walter's answer to my question makes God's question to Adam into a sign of his love for Adam, and he goes further to explain that this dialogue is an historical and archetype of humanity. If nothing else, it means that this is the way in which God views his relationship with us. God enjoys being with us and interacting with us, and when that relationship grows cold, he misses us. The British writer Julian Barnes begins his poignant memoir, Nothing to be Frightened of, with the words, "I do not believe in God, but I miss him." Those words set the tone for a book in which Barnes writes about his complicated and fraught relationship with the transcendent. In his book, Barnes expresses his curiosity about what God is like. And amidst the deep and rich thoughts woven throughout the book, the reader never encounters the idea that while Barnes misses God, it might also be true that the God on the other side of the question misses him. To be honest, in all my thinking about God, it is just now that I'm beginning to ponder the thought that when I move away from God on some level, he misses me. Could it really be possible that the God of creation misses me? Could it be possible that when we move away from God, he notices, he misses us? God's question to Adam, punctuated by Christ the Lord restoring the severed relationship through his death on the cross and resurrection, demonstrates God's great capacity to love us. As we approach Easter, wherever we might find ourselves on the spectrum of belief, whether we attend church, synagogue, temple, mosque, or none, whether we have faith, a little faith, beleaguered faith, or no faith, the story of God asking that penetrating question to Adam, and ultimately coming to us in Christ, is the supreme portrait of what God is like. Easter reminds us that the nature of God's love is such that when we walk away, God feels that loss. He misses us. And he comes looking for us. Thank you for listening. Remember to subscribe to this podcast to get more curated articles from Seen and Unseen Aloud. We hope you discover a world that is greater, more full of meaning and sense than you ever imagined.